Hey, everyone. This is Left, Right, and Center. I am David Greene. You know, we talk about the stakes in this presidential election this fall. Well, I think we should say the stakes are pretty damn high in Congress as well. We have 33 Senate seats up for grabs in the Senate in November, and of course, every seat in the House. Republicans are holding that tight majority in the House. Democrats have their slim majority in the Senate. But, you know, all of that could change. And whether Congress is in lockstep with a President Biden in a second term or a President Trump in a second term, or whether Congress is challenging the White House agenda at every step, that could shape our country's politics in a huge way in the next 4 years. One of the most fascinating dynamics, I think, this fall is that candidates running for House and Senate seats from either party don't exactly have a presidential candidate who's easy to rally around. In election years past, some of those in tight races might be looking to help, you know, whip up enthusiasm around their party's presidential nominee to drive voter turnout and help them get over the line. But not much seems to be normal about where we find ourselves in 2024. For Republicans, Donald Trump's popularity within the party doesn't seem to extend to the candidates that he supports. And there are concerns that his campaign message focusing on things like absolving participants in the January 6 riots and reshaping executive control, not exactly motivating factors. I think about hearing South Dakota Republican Senator John Thune, who is hoping to succeed Mitch McConnell as Republican leader. He was asked recently on PBS NewsHour why he is endorsing Trump after he criticized him for his involvement in the January 6th insurrection. I'm not sure we would call this a ringing endorsement.
So why support him today if what he did then was inexcusable?
Well, look, I said what I said then, and I'm not going to relitigate it, but I think what we have in front of us now is a very clear choice. And the voters, Republican voters around the country, have made clear that they want former President Trump to be the Republican nominee. And I've said I would support the Republican nominee, and I think now we have a clear choice.
Thune basically saying there, well, everyone seems to want former President Trump, and so I'm going to endorse him because now we have a clear choice. So for Democrats, the situation sort of different, but sort of the same. President Biden has low approval numbers, as well as these concerns about his age and sharpness. And his strong support, at least early on, for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has put Democrats in a tough spot, with many voters on the left horrified by the suffering and the death toll that they see in Gaza. And so a lot of Democrats who are running are facing a difficult situation to navigate. That's where I want to start today. We have Moa Lathy here, as always, executive director at Georgetown's Institute of Politics and Public Service. He was also communications director for the Democratic National Committee. Sarah Isger is out this week, but we are fortunate to be joined again by Michaela Carr. She was former chief of staff and former general counsel for Kevin McCarthy when he was Speaker of the House. She's also a fellow now at Georgetown discussing law and politics in the modern era. Moa, Michaela, hello to you both.
Hi, David. Thanks.
Hey, David.
Michaela, can I start with you and what we heard from John Thune there? I mean, he is saying there's a clear choice. He's saying that you know, he believes that President Biden would be not good for the country and a better choice would be Donald Trump. But, you know, just not saying much about Trump's agenda, what he would bring, who he is, why people should like him. I mean, is what do you make of that? And how hard is that for Republicans, you know, down ballot and across the board with someone like Donald Trump and his personality and sort of his rhetoric leading the party now?
You know, it's really interesting to kind of reflect on that a little bit. I think the question itself speaks to where we are in this era of politics that is so driven by personality.
Yeah.
Everybody knows who Donald Trump is. He has been very clear from the beginning. But when people like Thune, like what he said is like, look, there are things that I am happy to criticize him about. But when we look at what is the best path forward for this democracy, it's not just the top of the ticket. It's not just Biden versus Trump. It is approximately 1,200 political appointees, 800 of which require Senate confirmation. It is the entire fabric of how our federal government will respond to the next 4 years, what will happen with our policies, what will happen with national security, what will happen with our vision on the world stage, what will happen with our tax policies. And so when we think there's a concern or a disagreement that someone might have with the top of the ticket, and so therefore, if you don't like a personality, if you don't like some really horrific things that you think have been said or done, ultimately, if it is a binary choice, which is, I think, what we're looking at, absent some weirdness from a third party, if it's a binary choice, the decisions, the economic policies, the national security policies, the fiscal policies that Trump and the Republican conservative majorities would bring in to the next 4 years versus another 4 years of Biden, for a lot of people, that's a really clear choice. And I think when you talk about how that, what that looks like when you're running for Congress, so down ballot, I think it's going to be really interesting. You know, you look at, let's just use Long Island as an example. You've got Garbarino, LaLota, Lawler, some of my favorite guys in the House. They're in Republican seats that were Biden plus 12, Biden plus 10, Biden plus 8. And so when we look at what that's going to mean, some of those people, Trump went and campaigned in some areas, he very much didn't for a lot of reasons. But I think it makes a really good reminder, A, that politics aren't just about personalities. Yes, there's been personalities, but there's real ramifications for the future of the country and what our policies will look like. But also that down ballot, you know, in a lot of ways, politics are local. And so people that go to the voting booth and vote for Lawler maybe didn't always vote for Trump. Maybe they did vote for Biden, or maybe they withheld a vote. And so I think it'll be really interesting to play out, but I think it highlights that it's not really quite that black and white.
Hmm. So, Mo, I'm curious what you think here, but Mikhail, what I'm hearing you say is that what Thune is saying, I mean, I was kind of portraying it as he's, you know, doing a difficult dance to avoid, you know, criticizing Trump, but you're saying that the message that he and others might be sending to voters is, hey, yeah, there are a lot of things that you might not like about Donald Trump. Let's just put that out there on the table. But when we talk about things that are going to affect your community and your life, tax policy, other issues, like, that's what you should be focusing on. At the end of the day, you know, someone like Donald Trump might be better for your life and the future of your family and your community than someone like Joe Biden. It's okay to decide an election while being honest about things that you might despise, let's say, about, you know,
absolutely. And the American populace made that decision in 2016 when some of the comments or some of the criticisms around then candidate Trump were brought to the forefront. There were a lot of people that said, this candidacy's over. This is never going to happen. Even just think about the relatively, in hindsight, relatively small scuffle around the release of the tax returns. Every president candidate's always released the tax returns. He's like, I'm not doing it. Right. They elected him anyway. So to act as though somehow this personality is the bellwether on whether the policies that are put forth in our national security and our standing in this country and our economic well-being and our energy policy and our energy independence and our ability to drive gas-powered vehicles, you know, that relies on not just who the person is, but who that person is controls, again, the 1,200 political appointees and all of the people that they hire and how much control the federal government has in your individual life.
Mo, Donald Trump and Joe Biden could not be more different, but that dynamic, that sort of mindset, that looking more at policies and how they'll affect my life and getting away from how you might feel about the personality of one person, is that similar to the position that Democratic voters are in?
Well, first of all, you know, I love Michaela's answer, and I think there's so much to unpack there. An even better example from 2016, I would argue, than the fight over tax returns was the Access Hollywood tape, right? I mean, how many people thought when that came out that his candidacy was over, to the point where his own running mate almost dropped off the ticket?
I think we all thought that was it. That was the end of him.
And enough voters said, I'm so disgusted by this, but there's something else I dislike even more. And this is the number one caution I keep giving my fellow Democrats, is as outraged as we are, left of the center pole on the ideological spectrum, as outraged as we are, how many times do we need to get burned to realize we can't take it for granted that there are enough voters out there that are willing to overlook all of the terrible because of whatever reason they've got. And I think that's important heading in, moving forward, and why you do see this dynamic, why you do see so many candidates actually willing to embrace the terrible, embrace the outrageous, and then try to turn it around, because they get this, they get that our politics right now are driven more by personality and outrage than they are by ideology. And why I think you are seeing both candidates in this race stoking the flames of outrage, how outrageous the other side is, because that is far more potent today. I think in 2016, Mikhaila was absolutely right, that there were enough people out there saying, well, let's look at the judiciary and the judges. I may not like Donald Trump, but he's going to give me my tax cut or my judges, and so I'll hold my nose. I'm not sure that's the exact same dynamic this time. Where I would quibble a little bit with your question, David, and Michaela will probably laugh at me when I say this, but I do see one big difference. I don't think that Joe Biden, you started the question by saying that you got two candidates that are hard for people to get behind.
Yeah.
I don't know that Democrats have a hard time getting behind Joe Biden. They're just not excited to get behind Joe Biden.
Have you seen his approval numbers?
But this is my issue. They're not excited, but they will be fine in a head-to-head contest. They will be fine with him. They wish there was somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But if he's our guy, we got nothing against him. Democrats, right? I'm not talking about independents. We can have a completely separate conversation about that. I do think that there are a lot of Republicans in swing districts who find Donald Trump to be a hard guy to get behind, but they don't feel like they've got a choice for all the reasons we've been talking about.
Go ahead, Michaela.
I was going to say that's really interesting because I don't disagree, but what I would say is that, so A, you started with a comment from Whip Thune, and one, I'd like to highlight that I think it's healthy and good for people of the same party to be able to say, I don't like X, but I still think it's a better choice for our country. I think a lot of Republicans have done a very, very good job doing that over the last several years. And every time they do it, it's never enough. It's, oh, well, you criticize this, but you didn't criticize it 17 times. You didn't use the words that I want to say. Having a disagreement about some big thing, some small thing, policy, and calling that out, I think it's healthy and good. And second, I'd like to just say to what Mo said, I think he's right about Biden. I think there are a lot of Republicans who are excited about Trump.
Yeah. I look at a state like Georgia, and this is where it's going to be so interesting to watch. In states like Georgia, where in 2020, Donald Trump lost Georgia, right? Like, no matter what he says now, he lost Georgia by the most narrow of margins. And when you talk to the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, he says, yeah, that's because there were 30,000 people in the state of Georgia who voted straight ticket Republican but left President blank. They couldn't bring themselves to support the top of the ticket. They couldn't bring themselves to vote for Joe Biden, but they wanted to make sure, to Michaela's point, right, that there were Republicans down ballot. What happens in states like that this time? I mean, I know what the polling says now, but polls are not predictive. And it still shows that in all these battleground states, it's very close. What happens in a state like Maryland, where you've got Larry Hogan, a former popular governor, running for the Senate in a Republican running in a deep blue state on the same ballot as Donald Trump? He's been such a huge Trump critic. Now he's got to share a ballot with the guy for the very first time. He's never had to share a ballot with Donald Trump before. What does he do now in a deep blue state? Does he continue to diss himself, or does he try to just blur the lines between him and Trump under the assumption that Trump will turn out Republicans in Maryland that wouldn't normally turn out? This election is going to be so fascinating because I don't think we can predict the answers to any of these questions yet. And I don't think 2024 is going to be like either 2020 or 2016.
But Mo, how worried are you about turnout in general when you have a candidate who you are saying yourself is fine? I mean, fine doesn't always turn out voters for that candidate or for other candidates in his party. Like, fine is not what you got into politics for, right?
So I'm going to agree with Michaela in that I think Donald Trump is able to bring out more passion amongst both those who love him and hate him, right? Like, he is a candidate who instills passion in voters, either positive or negative passion, whereas Joe Biden, maybe not. He's not the passionate guy, right? So I look, am I worried about turnout? I don't know the answer to that, right? Who would have predicted in 2020 it would be the highest turnout in a race where both candidates were so disliked, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, even in 2020, they both would receive more votes than any two candidates in American history.
That's right.
Like, I don't know. Voters turn out for lots of different reasons. Sometimes it's for positive. Sometimes it's for negative. There's going to be a lot of people who are very passionate and scared of Donald Trump that will turn out and hold their nose for Joe Biden.
Although there have been some questions about whether that anti-Trump vote is going to be as strong in 24 as it is in 20. We have to take a quick break, but we're going to come back and pick up this conversation. Mo Lathy, Michaela Carr, and I will be right back with more Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Mo Lathy is here, Executive Director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. And Michaela Carr is here. She was Chief of Staff and General Counsel to the former Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. And we were talking about kind of the reality that people running for seats in Congress this fall face, given that the two people at the top of their tickets, presidential tickets, are Donald Trump and Joe Biden, and whether that's making life complicated for them if we look down ballot. And I want to play a little bit of tape from one House member. It's Jamal Bowman, a Democrat. He was part of the so-called squad. He's running to keep his seat in New York State. He has been critical of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israeli policy in the war against Hamas, to a point that he's now facing a primary challenger who's supported by pro-Israeli groups, and Bowman is down in the polls and looks like he very well might lose in the upcoming primary. And he's been speaking recently about the power of pro-Israeli lobbying groups like AIPAC and what he is facing when he brings up concerns about Israeli policy.
And when you challenge AIPAC, brother, like, the calls I get in my office are out of control. Like, the calls, the letters, the emails, like, my office stops functioning because we have to respond to all of the incoming, the intimidation tactics, the bullying, again, the weaponization of being against Israel. All of that happens. And my colleagues, many of them don't want to deal with that. Like, my colleagues, a lot, you know, with not all of them, many of them, their goal is to not have a primary race. If I didn't say anything, I wouldn't even be in the primary right now. I would just be chilling.
So that was Congressman Jamal Bowman on Hot 97 in New York City. And Mo, I just wonder, like, we have this war. We have President Biden, who came out in, you know, full-throated support for Benjamin Netanyahu initially, and now we, you know, have him being somewhat critical, but we also, you know, see the Washington Post now reporting that the United States government was sending Israel more weapons on the day that humanitarian aid workers from an organization like World Central Kitchen were killed in an Israeli airstrike. I Jamal Bowman sounds like he might lose his seat over this complexity. Don't think so?
No. Jamal Bowman is not being primaried because of his position on Israel-Gaza. Jamal Bowman is being primaried because he's Jamal Bowman, because he pulled a fire alarm in order to avoid a vote and then lied about it, getting sanctioned by the Ethics Committee in the House. He's being primaried because he's just not very good at politics, not because of his position on Israel-Gaza. There are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who are going to be just fine, who share his position on Israel-Gaza, and then don't need to turn around and drive even bigger wedges. Chuck Schumer is the Democratic leader in the Senate. Nobody has been more pro-Israel in the Democratic Party than Chuck Schumer. He's now coming out and calling out and taking a more pro-Palestinian position in Gaza. So let's just be clear about that situation. Now, the bigger question I think you're asking, David, is just how is this issue of Israel-Gaza going to impact the election?
But you're saying Bowman is out either way. I mean, if the war in Gaza were not taking place, I mean, he's...
I don't know that Bowman is out, but Bowman would be primaried either way. Mm-hmm. It's a unique case that I don't think we should extrapolate national lessons from. But having said that, look, there are a lot of Democrats, and I would say a majority of the Democratic Party, and increasingly a majority of voters writ large, who are squeamish with how Israel is waging this war. And we've talked about this issue so many times. It is possible to be pro-Israel, anti-Hamas, pro-release of hostages, but also support more rights for the Palestinian people, support an end to the war for the Palestinian people, and be critical of Bibi Netanyahu's waging the war. All those things can all be true at the same time.
But can you message that effectively? I agree. You can feel those things as a policymaker, as a person.
So we have seen the protest vote. We have seen people voting Democrats voting uncommitted in the Democratic primaries in a number of states. Will those people remain uncommitted? That's the big question. Now, you see some of the leaders of that movement say, don't worry, we will be there in the general election because we understand Donald Trump is worse for the Palestinian people than Joe Biden is. We understand that Donald Trump would give Bibi Netanyahu a blank check while also deporting Muslims from the country. We understand all that, but we want to put pressure on the president now. So I think most of those people will come home, but how many won't? Is it 10%? Is it 5%? In a state like Michigan, that could be enough to change the outcome, and that does worry me. I would like to see Democrats be more aggressive in drawing the contrast between Joe Biden and Donald Trump on this issue. With a targeted campaign in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, they can, I think, really impact and mitigate this dynamic by reminding people that one candidate will be better for a lasting peace in the Middle East than the other. One will be better for the Palestinian people than the other. I'm not hearing that.
Well, let me ask you, Michaela, and then Mo, I want you to come back to this question too, because I think so many voters who I know personally are watching what is happening in Gaza. They're horrified. They feel a level of anger at President Biden and the White House, feeling like that he was too supportive of Benjamin Netanyahu in the beginning, and they want their voice to be heard somehow. And I just wonder, what do you both tell voters who want to express that passion at the ballot box somehow in you know, a protest vote or whatever you call that, and that makes it harder for them to vote for President Biden and, frankly, to vote for a Democratic candidate who has been supportive of the White House? What is the message to them?
I mean, the message to voters, I think, is that are looking at what is happening and are thinking that either President Biden or former President Trump are being too supportive of Israel, is that I think there maybe needs to be a re-education campaign. Mm. I mean, the reality is there is an indigenous people that have been on this land for thousands of years. The occupational tropes just don't, they don't align with history. They don't align with accuracy. And these, you know, there was a ceasefire on October 4th, and there was a ceasefire on October 5th, and there was a ceasefire on October 6th. And what the ceasefire did was allowed time for Hamas to rearm and plan an attack. And so when we have Jamal Bowman saying that the criticism of Israel, that he is getting calls because he, quote unquote, went against AIPAC, therefore alleging or inferring that a powerful lobbying group is the reason that he is getting calls, not his actual policy positions, which I think is what people are, that is why people are calling him. And so I think when we look at, you know, what is happening, even the devastation that comes with civilian casualties, like the aid workers that were killed this week. I mean, no one has ever, and probably will ever be able to again, engage in warfare in a way that protects civilians as much as Israel is doing now. I think it's a really, really tough issue. I think people have really strong feelings on all sides. And I think Mo's right that we have to let people have their vote. I don't know where Mo is on this. I'd be interesting to hear, but the protest vote in Michigan, for someone from my view, I don't look at that and worry that they're going to stay home on the general election day. I look at that and think, they're making their statement that they don't like this, and they're hoping to, I think, in a correct way, effectuate change in policy by doing this protest vote. But from an outsider to the Democrat Party, I don't look at that and worry that Michigan's not going to show up for Biden. That protest vote was a way for them to influence policy. And I think the Schumer floor speech where he basically calls for an election and says, if you don't have this election, we're going to kind of re-envision our aid, shows that that might have been really effective on their part.
My question back to you, Michaela, though, is do you feel, I mean, we look at some of the primaries in the past couple of weeks on the Republican side. Donald Trump's already the presumptive nominee, and he's still losing 20-25% of Republicans to Nikki Haley because her name was just pre-printed on the ballot. Do you feel the same way about those folks? Do you think those folks will come back to Donald Trump in the fall, or is that something they should be worried about?
That's a really good question. I think the dynamics are really different, mm-hmm. but I think the outcome is almost the same. So I would say 99% of the Michigan protest voters, this is not scientific, obviously, are right, going to come right. back to Biden. I think with the Nikki Haley voters that are still voting after she has stepped back, I'd probably say 85. Now, that's a pretty high number, 85, 87. But when we're looking at a couple of states that might come down to 2 or 3 percentage points, I think it's a really interesting number. But I think the vast majority, 100% yes, but there are some that are like, I won't do it.
And that to me, I couldn't agree with you more on this. I do think, I mean, you listen to sort of the cable news pundits, right? And they would say both are huge red flags for both candidates, right? The uncommitted vote in Michigan and Wisconsin and a few other places, a huge red flag for the Biden campaign. The Nikki Haley vote is a huge red flag for the Trump campaign. I think they are red flags. I don't know how big yet, but I think I would agree with you that it is more likely that those uncommitted voters in Michigan come back to President Biden than it is for the Nikki Haley voter in the past couple of weeks to come back to Donald Trump. Both will get huge majorities back, but I do think Biden will get a few more of those folks. And that's what's going to make this race so interesting, right? Is because in all of these battleground states, a few more is all it takes, right?
All right. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. And we've been talking about, President Biden and former President Trump and sort of the position that they have down ballot Democrats and Republicans in running with candidates at the top who are not the strongest candidates for president that we've seen in history. I want to shift a little bit to a different topic, and that's the topic of religion. Sunday, March 31st was Easter. Easter falls on all different days. Last Easter was April 9th, 2025. It's going to be April 20th. But this year, Easter fell on what was also the Transgender Day of Visibility. Since 2009, members and allies of the transgender community have marked the last day of March to celebrate accomplishments and contributions of the transgender community, as well as to raise awareness about the discrimination they face. And President Biden acknowledged both Easter and the Transgender Day of Visibility, which sparked outrage from some critics on the right, some accusing the president of trying to overshadow or replace Easter. I don't have to tell anyone that when religion comes up in politics, especially during elections, it can be complicated. I think about this recent Pew Research poll that 80% of U.S. adults feel that religion is losing its influence in American life. And that, to me, could be one reason perhaps why some on the right wanted to be seen as fighting for Easter and standing up for Easter and its prominence. But I wonder, did either or both of you take a sort of larger lesson from that whole conversation?
Look, my take on that kind of notice that people took to how the president responded to Easter and marking the awareness of the Transgender Day of Awareness. I think there has been, yes, it's been done for several years. I think there is no disagreement or argument that in the last several years, especially the last 2 or 3, there's been a real heightened sensitivity to what is seen by many as a kind of a reduction in rights that were fought for generations and for decades to allow women to have spaces that were just for their own. And I think that fight has kind of come to the forefront. And so I think there is a heightened sensitivity right now that just didn't exist in 2009.
Sure.
And so I think that there is probably what led to some of the hyperbole. I think when we look at that, the 80% number that you just mentioned from the Pew Research Center is really interesting to me, because I think of this in a lot of ways, like many things, the pendulum swings, right? The pendulums kind of swing back and forth about where religion fits into people's lives and family. I think there's been significant changes even since COVID of kind of like pulling back and having like an additional focus on religion and family, and a focus on kind of a separation from the government that you see specifically on the right, when you see massive overreach of government power, people retreat to different areas. And when you look at kind of how our leaders treat religion, it is has to be viewed through the lens of what makes America exceptional. It is the only nation founded, conceived in liberty, the only one built on an idea, right? And our declaration says, endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights. And the reality is that every single law that we pass is making a judgment call on what is right and wrong, what is good and bad, what is the right thing to do here. And how do we make those judgment calls? Well, for a really long time, and in our traditions, we make those judgment calls based on morality and based on religion. And in fact, I mean, John Adams, one of my favorite John Adams quotes is that, you know, this, we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. And so when we try and look back and say that somehow it is antithetical to bring religion into our political life, I think it's really kind of ignoring all of our history and our foundation as a country.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and hear from Mo and continue talking about this in just a moment. We'll be back with more Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Greene, here with Michaela Carr, who until recently was chief of staff to former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. And Mo Alethi is here, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. We were talking about some of the criticism that President Biden got honoring Easter and also the Transgender Day of Visibility, which was March 31st. Some, including former President Trump, criticizing the president for not, in their view, what should have been just honoring and elevating Easter on that day. And Mo, I wonder where you are here. Like, I have absolutely no problem at all with the White House saying there are two important things to mark today. Is there something that President Biden could have done differently in some way to honor kind of what Michaela was saying a few minutes ago before our break, that, I mean, given the current political climate, given what we're seeing in the culture wars, that, you know, bringing up an issue like transgender rights does hit people in different ways? Or is it just the president believes in supporting the transgender community? These were two moments that he wanted to honor, and he just did it and has to take the backlash.
I mean, I would have loved to have seen them lean in a little bit more and said, you know what, the Easter Bunny visits families with trans people too, right? Mm. Like, I mean, this is where I worked for Bill Bradley in 2000 when he was running for president. And Bradley would often get asked questions about his faith. And his standard response was, that's actually none of your business. Mm. Like, faith is too personal of a thing. And I always thought, I have so much respect for Bill Bradley, but I always thought that was an issue where he missed the mark. Because for a lot of people, faith and character, faith and morality are intertwined. And so helping people understand who you are is an important part of running for president. Faith does have the ability to help us understand one another and help us find some commonalities. I think I agree with Michaela about 50% in talking about how sort of faith in public life represents what is great about America. I actually agree with that. But I also think it has represented the worst of America in the way we then use faith as a political weapon against one another. And that's not new to this period of time. We know how people used John F. Kennedy's Catholicism against him when he was running for president. We have seen anti-Semitism in our politics. We have seen Islamophobia in our politics. We have seen different Christian denominations being pitted against one another in our politics. And I do think we are seeing some of that now, right, in cases like this, where rather than find the common humanity on a day like Easter, some chose to use that as a political bludgeon, trying to say somehow Catholic Joe Biden is less Christian because he is willing to acknowledge trans people on the same day as Easter. That is not the best of America. I don't think it is new to this era in our history, and I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon.
Michaela, can I finish this topic with a question for you? I have often thought, and Mo, I agree with you, Bill Bradley's approach to me was the wrong one. I mean, the more you can reveal yourself, especially in an era where voters are so interested in personality and the person, the better. I've often thought that President Biden should talk more about his own Catholic faith and the fact that he's the second U.S. president to be Catholic. And Michaela, I just wonder, like, independent voters who might be more religious and might, like, be waiting for a reason to not vote potentially for President Trump and to vote for Joe Biden, would hearing more about President Biden's faith and Catholicism, you know, help sort of make them feel a connection to the president?
That's such an interesting question. My initial instinct is no, because I think the person that you describe is going to be really put off by the life issue and President Biden's stance on that. And I think when people that are really struggling with an independent voter struggling with a choice, but has a strong faith background, I think, where my mind went was that they're going to have a hard time with the life issue, and that him talking more about Catholicism while taking that position, I don't see that Venn diagram closing.
And I'd also point, like, none of this is predictive, right? I mean, look at Donald Trump's stranglehold over the evangelical community. The fact that the evangelical community is rock solid behind a guy who has not lived a life that is always consistent with what evangelicals say is important to them, right?
Yeah.
They are willing to overlook a lot of those flaws for other reasons. And so none of this is predictive, but I do think the more candidates can open up and tell people what motivates them.
Yeah.
And if some of that is faith, I think we are all richer as a people for knowing that.
Yeah. I want to finish the show today by turning back to our 50 states series we've been doing all year. This is when we're trying to visit all 50 states before the presidential election and sort of capture one story on the ground to see what we can learn about our larger national political conversation. And we're going to turn to Kansas. And the subject is one of the most important elements of our democracy, which is voting. I mean, it's a right that many people through history have fought to enjoy, to be able to choose their elected leaders and shape the legislation that governs them. So I always wonder why it sometimes seems like we just make the process of voting in our country so damn complicated. And we're looking at Kansas. Republican lawmakers there are redrafting a proposal to eliminate the grace period for mail-in ballots to come in after the polls close. Right now, mail-in voters in Kansas have their ballot counted, provided that it arrives within 3 days after polls close. Starting next year, the proposal would eliminate that grace period while also extending the advance voting period from 20 to 22 days. You know, Michaela, we hear from Republicans saying that this is all about election integrity. I think that the political cynic in me says this is because they think that all those votes that are going to arrive in the 3 days after the polls close are probably going to be for Democrats. Where do you see this? Do you see a valid reason to be eliminating a grace period and yet again changing how voting works?
Absolutely. I will start with, look, we want in our democracy, we want voting to be make we want to make it easy to vote and hard to cheat. And when we do that right, we have really high voter confidence.
Yeah.
If your voters have confidence in what's happening, then they will have higher voter turnout. I think both parties I will speak only for Republicans. We believe if more people turn out, we win, right? We want people to turn out. Our ideas are the best ideas. So therefore, if we can get our ideas out there and more people will turn out, we win. So on an easy to vote, hard to cheat. I think one of the things that's lost in this conversation a lot is how very easy we make it to vote in this country when you compare it with literally anything else, any other democracy on the planet, any other time in our own history. We have made it remarkably easy to vote. And I'm glad you mentioned the 22 days beforehand, because what Kansas essentially has is a voting month. You have 22 days to get a ballot. You have 22 days to turn your ballot in. And there's one day where, you know, I'm kind of traditional. I actually go to the polls and I take my kids and I use it as an opportunity to learn. And we get the sticker, the I voted sticker, or my little kids get the future voter sticker. It's a patriotic duty that I am teaching my children. But the idea that having a set of rules and norms by which American citizens must follow or meet in order to choose their elected leader, that that is somehow antithetical to democracy, really frustrates me. We have the most liberal voting laws on the books. We usually, Europe is far to the left of us, and for good reason. But here we are outflanking Europe. You look at, there's in 27 countries in the European Union, 17 of them have absolutely banned mail-in voting unless you're overseas. We have some federal regulations making sure that our overseas service members can always vote by mail. When you look at OECD countries, half of the member states have completely banned mail-in voting. And so when we have states like Kansas saying, hey, let's have people have their vote counted before the election's over, which seems like a very basic requirement, that gets a lot of pushback because people are looking for a wedge issue to drive people to division. And I think that it's really, really important that we have rules that are clear at the start and then that people follow them.
Well, I mean, Michaela just presented a pretty compelling case. I got to say, I came into this very cynically thinking that this is all about suppressing Democratic votes and that the people who might be too busy with work or, you know, not have time to or struggle to get to the polls might be Democrats, and they get in that 3-day grace period and now they won't be counted. But do you hear Michaela on this? I mean, maybe there is a reason to just, you know, rules are okay.
Of course rules are okay. I mean, find me a Democrat who says rules aren't okay.
I mean, that we should have. Why get rid of this grace period?
No, but this is, I mean, I listen to Michaela and I share her frustration with people who say there shouldn't be rules or that the rules should be changed midstream. Like, we should have clear and concise rules about who can vote. And while elections, I don't think it is a problem to make elections as easy as possible. And if we can find a way to make it even easier for some people, that's a good thing too, right? Those two ideals should not be inconsistent with one another. And I do look at some of the moves to amend election laws in recent years. I look at a state like Florida, which had early voting on college campuses over an entire month and suddenly started to restrict the time frame and the number of polling places where you could vote early. Why is that important? Because for a lot of people, election day, I'm with you, Michaela, I love taking my kids to the polls on election day, and we turn it into a big thing as well. But not everybody can do that. So creating some opportunities for people to vote at a different time within a well-established and regulated window with clear rules is a good thing. When people get accustomed to that, and then we start to roll it back and start to restrict and start to contract the number of polling places and days available, suddenly it starts to feel like it's becoming more burdensome for people. And I don't like that feeling either. I'm with you. I think people do want to use this as a wedge issue. Republicans are frustrated because they think Democrats are trying to do that. Democrats are incredibly frustrated because we feel like Republicans are trying to do that. And you know what? Look at the 2020 election, and they are, right? Look at the way mail-in voting was talked about in the run-up to and the aftermath of the 2020 election. Look at the way the entire electoral system was being treated in the aftermath of the 2020 election. And you can see why there are people who suddenly are really, really nervous on the left that there are going to be efforts to change the rules yet again, once again, midstream, in ways that would further restrict people's expectations on how they're able, how and when they're able to vote. That concerns me because I do think that feeds into people's distrust in elections just as much as what Michaela was talking about, feeding into distrust amongst people on the right.
I guess I just worry that the confusion feeds mistrust. It's not like some of these debates are totally worth having and deciding where the rules should be and what the timeline should be, but that the just a general state of confusion about what the rules are makes it hard on people. And that in itself, just the confusion can lead to distrust and a feeling that this is not this just fundamental bedrock thing that you can all believe in because you've got to pay attention to the latest headline from your local newspaper to figure out when and how to vote. But maybe there's a way to avoid that at some point soon. We're going to have to leave it there. I do want to say, if you have a suggestion from your state for a story that fits into our 50 States series, share it with us on the Left, Right, and Center webpage at KCRW.com. You can go to the Get in Touch tab, leave your story there. We'd love suggestions for what we should be covering around the country that gives us a window into our political conversation. And it is time for our Left, Right, and Center rants and raves. Michaela, I will turn it over to you.
I have a rave this week. I haven't finished reading the book yet, so I'm always leery to promote a book that I haven't completely finished, but I'm in the middle of reading Coleman
tentative
Hughes'
rave,
book.
Tentative rave.
Tentative rave.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm in the middle of reading Coleman Hughes' book, The End of Race Politics, and I am enjoying it so very much. I'm not only enjoying the subject, of course, obviously, I'm obsessed with politics, so I enjoy this kind of literature, but the way that he writes, it's a conversation, it's really thought-provoking and very well-researched, which is a wonderful combination, and so I am raving about that book right now and very much enjoying it.
Nice. Mo?
I'm glad you're sitting down, David, because I'm about to blow you away.
Okay.
I'm going to rave as well. Wow. I never rave. I am going to rave today. Last week, I was out. I missed the show last week because I'd taken my kids to on their spring break to London. I could spend my whole rave talking about London, but I'm going to talk specifically about one site in London. We went and visited the Churchill War Rooms. If you ever get a chance to go to London, Winston Churchill's underground bunker, where he and his war cabinet met almost daily for 6 years while London was being bombed by the Nazis, is open to the public. And walking through the map room, which is left almost entirely intact with the original maps on the wall, where you can get up close and see the actual pinholes from where they were tracking troop movements, was awesome and awe-inspiring and humbling to be in the presence of that. And it just reminded me, not only being in the presence of such a momentous place in world history, but also reminded me of a time when allies were able to come together to defeat a common foe under the most extraordinary of circumstances. And while I hope we don't ever have to face a foe like that again, it does make me wish we could find ways for allies to come together once again to defeat or behind a common purpose, which we just don't seem to see a lot of these days.
I love that you went there. It's so funny. I was talking just a couple nights ago. I was talking to two friends about that very site in London. It's an amazing place to visit. I want to finish the show by ranting about what happened to 7 aid workers from World Central Kitchen in Gaza. I've known that organization for years and watched their work during COVID to help feed people and help restaurants. I got to see them up close in their work in Ukraine. These are just some of the best people in the humanitarian aid space who believe that no matter what, it's not about picking sides or getting involved into involved in the politics of a war. It's just the dignity of a meal for people who are suffering. And they took that philosophy to Gaza. And then 7 members from World Central Kitchen were hit and killed in an Israeli airstrike. I don't care where you are on a certain war or a conflict, that That is cruel. It's unacceptable. World Central Kitchen is calling for an independent investigation into what happened. And I think that should absolutely happen because we need to understand how that happens and how we can prevent it from ever happening again. Okay, that is our show for today. Michaela and Mo, thank you so much. Great discussion. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Phil Richards. Sue Margulies, Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green, and would love you to come back next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.